From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Robin Lustig, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This Friday, the U.S. will celebrate the 227th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence. But almost 600 years before Jefferson's letter to King George III, another English king signed the Magna Carta. And there, on the muddy banks of Runnymede, the first official recognition of individual human rights. But that is only half the story. Tonight on Point, the secret history of the Magna Carta, its influence and importance in the Western and developing worlds today. But we begin in Washington, where today President Bush made it clear that continuing attacks against American forces in Iraq would not influence his decision on how long the troops would stay there. But the casualties are mounting. At least 31 U.S. and British military personnel have been killed and 178 wounded in combat in Iraq since President Bush declared an end to major combat operations in May. Dana Milbank is White House correspondent for The Washington Post. I asked him if the administration is worried that it could be getting dragged into a guerrilla war.
Well, Robin, they say emphatically that they don't consider that to be the case, but then they use terms like well-trained bands of 5 to 7 men who are attacking American troops. Now, that obviously sounds like the definition of a guerrilla war. They're very worried about the comparisons to Vietnam, and this is obviously somewhat different from that, but they are becoming aware that they've got a long-term problem on their hands, which is why the president said that yesterday.
Does it sound to you as if he is using a different form of language to what the American people have been accustomed to hearing from him on this issue until now?
It's the first time since, I believe it was May 1st, when he declared that major combat operations were over, that he spoke out in this extensive a way. So it was new in that sense. A lot of people have said, even some of the leading Republicans in the Congress have said that the rhetoric out of the administration, the president earlier on was sort of optimistic about post-war Iraq. All the emphasis was on the battle and very little was on the reconstruction period. The implications that people were led to believe that things would be a lot easier there than they are. As with so much else, it's about the expectations game and whether people understood and expected how difficult it would be. And there were, of course, plenty of voices out there saying exactly how difficult it was going to be.
But is it your understanding that, at least in private, there were those people in the administration who, even before the war began, were looking at the possibility that this was the kind of environment in which American troops would find themselves?
Obviously, there's military planners and intelligence experts who would understand that, so the government was well aware of this possibility beforehand. I think it's less a question that they weren't aware of this possibility or even that they were suggesting that things would be otherwise, just that they weren't emphasizing the post-war situation. All the emphasis was on removing Saddam Hussein with very little thought or public emphasis given to what happens afterwards. There was talk sort of in the long term about how this would be a catalyst for democracy throughout the Middle East, but getting to that point was not discussed in great detail. So I don't think it'd be fair to say that they misled people about the difficulty. They just didn't discuss the difficulty at all.
When the president uses a word like massive to describe the scale of the task that the U.S. is facing in Iraq, do you understand that to imply that he believes it may be necessary to increase the number of U.S. troops there?
That's a question we were going back and forth on actually today with Ari Fleischer's briefing. The Pentagon's due to decide by the middle of this month whether to add troops. The official answer is that that's always a possibility that it'll be increased or decreased. This will be constantly reviewed. But it is something that's obviously under consideration and some folks feel is necessary. On the other hand, there are not exactly a lot of spare troops kicking around that they can move over there on a moment's notice, and they're certainly eager to get away from the emphasis so far on using reserves. These people need to get back to their jobs.
What are they saying at the White House in private, Dana, about what the opinion polls are telling them? Because it is beginning to look, isn't it, as if American voters are becoming less convinced rather than more convinced that this operation is going well.
Well, they are, and then part of that reflects how enthusiastic people were about it in the early days when Baghdad fell, and you could see the support for the war and for the president and for every aspect of it shoot up, and people did not particularly care about what happened in the post-war Iraq, what happened with the finding of Saddam Hussein or the weapons of mass destruction. People are now beginning to digest those issues a bit more, and that's jeopardized the popularity. I don't think the White House is overly concerned about this in the long term. The president's so strong on all matters of military, foreign affairs, national security, that he really has little to fear. And he's also, as we could see in his remarks yesterday, pivoting to make the fight against these guerrillas, or whatever we're going to call them, in Iraq part of the overall war on terror, linking that to Afghanistan, Saudi Arabia, thereby positioning himself as a leader, as still a war president, still fighting an active war.
What about what used to be known as the body bag factor, this idea that no U.S. president can survive electorally a substantial number of U.S. casualties in combat? If this current situation in Iraq continues, perhaps for several more months, there's going to come a point, isn't there, when more U.S. servicemen and women will have been killed after the end of major combat operations than during the war itself?
Well, it stands to reason that we're on a path to do that, but you've got to keep the whole thing in perspective. Now, we're talking about, I think it's 23 Americans killed in combat, another 8 Britons killed in combat since May 1st. But let's take this in the context that everybody in the administration would be concerned about, and that's Vietnam, and that's that, you know, that would be just an ordinary day in that war, and we've got a long way till we get to the 50,000 dead, so that this could go on for 100 years. But obviously, in a vacuum with reports of more dead soldiers, that's not going to be helpful to the administration. On the other hand, we've sort of lost count of the regular losses in Afghanistan. Same thing could happen with Iraq, and it would just be accepted there'd be a low level of ongoing casualties. You also have to consider that more Americans have been killed in accidents in Iraq since the heavy combat was declared over than have been actually killed by a hostile fire.
How seriously are people taking the administration's claims of foreign involvement now in what's happening in Iraq and in the attacks, continuing attacks on U.S. troops?
Well, it's hard to say how seriously the American public is taking this. It's interesting, a poll came out yesterday indicated that a quarter of Americans believe that Saddam Hussein and his government were responsible for the September 11th attacks, which obviously is not correct. Every time the president makes a remark, his remarks have actually been reasonably careful lately when he details the links between Iraq and al-Qaeda, but the implication that a lot of people pick up is that the ties are much stronger than, in fact, they have been demonstrated to be in reality.
And he does believe that the attacks that we've been seeing over the past several days and weeks, at least some of them, may have been the work of people who have come into Iraq from outside specifically to attack Americans.
He said so yesterday, the foreign fighters entering, talking about both homegrown Iraqi terrorist groups and groups that he says are associates of al-Qaeda, if not al-Qaeda itself.
Dana Milbank, thank you very much indeed for talking with us.
Sure, thank you.
Dana Milbank is White House correspondent for The Washington Post. He spoke with us from Washington. The Magna Carta. Think of it, and images of a beleaguered King John probably come to mind. Or perhaps you think of its influence on the colonial charters and the American Declaration of Independence. 800 years ago, the Magna Carta first defined individual human rights. But our guest tonight says that is only half the story. The other half, the forgotten half, is what it says about community rights. So even in today's world, a world of conflicts over mineral and oil rights, from the forests of the Amazon to diamond mines in Sierra Leone and oil fields in Nigeria, can indigenous people look to the Magna Carta for protection against foreign commercial interests? Can the Magna Carta provide useful guidance for us in our globalized economy? What do you make of the rebirth of this ancient document? Join our conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me in the studio is Peter Linebaugh, Professor of History at the University of Toledo and author of The Secret History of the Magna Carta that appears in the summer issue of Boston Review magazine. Professor Linebaugh, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
Also in the studio is On Points news analyst Jack Beattie, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Jack, good to have you.
Pleasure to be with you, Robert.
Now, Professor Linebaugh, most people will be aware that the Magna Carta speaks of individual human rights. Tell us what it says about community rights.
Well, I think everyone knows that it stands for the rule of law, habeas corpus, trial by jury, and prohibition of torture, even though these four principles have suffered under the Patriot Act of the and other oppressions of the last 2 years in wartime. Most of us know that, and certainly it's on the door to the Supreme Court building, King John signing the Magna Carta, when in fact he couldn't write. Nevertheless, there is 61 chapters to this document, or to this parchment, and with that parchment is the Charter of the Forest. And here we have, in addition to the habeas corpus, trial of jury, and prohibition of torture and rule of law, we have reference to the hydrocarbon energy of the time, that is, to the woods and the woodlands. This was an economy 600 years ago that depended on woods very much the way we depend upon petroleum. And in fact, it's this comparison of hydrocarbon energy that first took me to Magna Carta. And what Magna Carta does is it recognizes in widows, estovers, panage, chiminage, all these
Wait a minute. What do all those words mean?
Yes, yes. We might think of them as common rights, where those who labored in the woods weren't just hey diddle diddle with Robin Hood, but were laboring largely in a non-commercial or subsistence economy, laboring in common and laboring with customary ways of production and reproduction.
But are you arguing that all of this in an ancient document many hundreds of years ago drawn up in England still has any relevance to the kind of world that we live in now in the 21st century?
Well, we don't know. If you look at Nigeria this last summer, if you look at Oaxaca in Mexico, if you look in Indonesia, or yourself mentioned Amazonas, here we find people who have relied on customary rights to the woodlands and to human resources. These are now being threatened not so much by foreigners, but as privatizing interests led by the World Bank and the IMF. So indigenous people, subsistence peasants, are questioning this privatization. And they are bringing up issues which to us may seem backward or seem criminal, those of us who take a perspective of pure commerce and commodity production. But from the standpoint of the millions of people who have been commoners in the world in these forests, maybe looking at Magna Carta again and these arcane English words will suggest to us not returning to a pre-technological society, but suggest human values of equality, egalitarianism, that we might heed. You mentioned Iraq, for example. The people of the reeds have been, between the Tigris and Euphrates, have been dispossessed. These were commoners. They've been dispossessed in the last 10 years. The same process is happening in Central America, in Indonesia. It's happening to our germplasm, to the genetic modified, privatized food plasm of the world is now being directly threatened.
We have this discussion just 2 days ahead of July 4th. The Declaration of Independence, widely believed, quite plainly built upon some of the very fundamental ideas and tenets that existed in the Magna Carta. But there is nothing about what you're just talking about now, community rights. Now, is that an accident, a mistake, or was it deliberate?
Well, I think it's twofold. It's good to read the Declaration of Independence, and I would recommend reading it just as reading the Magna Carta. But if we did read it, we would see that one of the beefs of the colonists in Massachusetts was George III took away our charters. And here in Massachusetts, Paul Revere designed the first state seal, and it showed a militiaman with Magna Carta in his hand.
Stay with us. I'm going to stop you there. We're going to take a break. We're talking tonight about the secret history and modern significance of the Magna Carta. You can join our conversation at 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Robin Lustig, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Robin Lustig, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Tonight, we're taking a new look at an old document, the Magna Carta, and what it says about community rights. Should indigenous people look to the 800-year-old Magna Carta when their land is taken by commercial interests? What rights do local communities have in our modern multinational world? You can join our conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined in the studio by Professor Peter Linebar and by On Point's news analyst Jack Beatty. Jack, do you think any of this new interpretation of the Magna Carta is relevant to us today?
Well, some forces stand between us and it seems to me. Capitalism, the Protestant Reformation, and industrial capitalism. That's a big hurdle. But what I'm struck with, Peter, in your story is how this, essentially, this part of the Magna Carta, the part about community rights, the part really what we would call about positive freedom, got left out in the 17th century by people who were working, sort of passing on this tradition. And, of course, what a moment of all time to do that, just when the enclosure movement that put an end to these commons, that created the modern proletariat, and that, as you well know, set millions of people in motion around the world and many hundreds of thousands to this country, that was beginning then too. And with it, really, I think a new idea of freedom, the one in our Declaration, negative freedom, what Isaiah Berlin calls negative freedom, freedom from the government, from, and this idea of positive freedom has faded really in that 17th century, and it isn't in our Declaration. But when one reads it, you know, he said, what is this positive freedom? You've got a great lyric of Shelley's. He says, what art thou, freedom? For the laborer it is bread and a comely table spread. Thou art clothes and fire and food for the trampled multitude. This is what freedom is, the basic stuff of life for people, whereas our understanding of it is, keep the government off my back.
Yes, I think Franklin Roosevelt had to twist Winston Churchill's arm to come around to Shelley's viewpoint. That is, that you had to put the food on the table before you began talking about freedom and la-di-da. And this is what was so shocking to me when Bush and Blair spoke to Congress after 9/11. Was that time had passed from the Atlantic Charter, because he assumed that we'd forget the four freedoms. He mentioned only two, worship and speech. And he forgot freedom from fear and freedom from want. And these are the starting points for Shelley. Social security, food on the table. And this is what the common rights of Magna Carta had also assumed.
But Peter Linebar, is it not true that the process of industrialization, the rise of capitalism, makes the Magna Carta something of history? You can no longer apply ideas, rights even, that were laid down all those centuries ago in an era when people work, live, earn a living in an entirely different way.
Robin, so much in the world today speaks just to your point. With the detained in Guantanamo Bay, with the removal of rights and habeas corpus for immigrants, with the destruction of Social Security and health for widows, with the privatization of our food and the world's genetic food plasm, everything seems to point that privatization is the way to go, more proletarianization. But I think there's also forces that are standing against this and are searching for some other way than cutthroat capitalism, some other way than an industrialization that pollutes, that destroys all over. And this is at the heart of the anti-globalization movement. The world is as you say, but what is the world to become? Can we learn something from the past? One doesn't want to bring about Robin Hood and Magna Carta again. But there are some values here that we need to restore, and I think habeas corpus, prohibition of torture, as well as widows' estovers.
These widows' estovers, which will mean absolutely nothing to most people, I confess they mean nothing to me until we started talking about them a few moments ago. You believe that for the people, let us say, of the Amazon forest, for the people of the oil-producing regions of Nigeria, perhaps even for the people of Iraq when the oil starts pumping again, there is a direct parallel which links the rights that King John and the barons talked about back in the 13th century and the situation that these people find themselves in today.
I think so. I think so. Of course, Jack, to come back to your interesting question, when you took us to the 17th century, when the Indians first saw the pilgrims, they said, "What brought you here? Did you run out of wood?" Because there is great truth in this. And now, are we running out of oil? Is this the background to the war in Colombia, the war in Iraq, the war in Indonesia, the war in Venezuela? I think this is the question that it raises.
Are you trying, Peter Linebar, to claim the Magna Carta as an intellectual weapon of benefit to the anti-war movement?
I think it is definitely the biggest statement against war has always been the widow.
Jack Beattie.
Well, that's certainly true. What did Kipling, he said, "Go to the widow maker." Wasn't that his what the army in effect was for him? Yeah. Well, this is interesting, trying to breathe new ideas. You know, we do have this very limited idea of freedom here. And strangely enough, our modern Republican Party began with a very different idea of freedom. The GOP, when it was founded in the 1850s, it was the party of free labor, free soil, and free men. But by free labor, Abraham Lincoln and the others didn't mean just free as opposed to slave. No, they meant something very different. They meant that a person couldn't really be free unless they were economically self-sufficient, unless they were independent. It was a sort of individualist spin on the commons tradition. And their idea was the independent farmer who had a competence, who didn't have to depend on someone else for his food, who has his own land, or if he was a shopkeeper, he had his own shop, and therefore he could make independent decisions, republican decisions, as in small republic, to disinterested decisions about the common weal. They couldn't be disinterested if he were desperate. And this was their basic idea of free labor, and the Homestead Act of 1862 was the embodiment of this. You could go west, get your acres, the government would give it to you, and you could become a sort of, you know, sort of star of the free labor system.
Well, so that was in the spirit of the Magna Carta.
That was definitely in the spirit of Magna Carta. The trouble was this was happening just at the moment of industrial capitalism. It was a nostalgic ideal. It was running out of gas, even as the Republicans were propounding
it. Jack, industrial capitalism, as you will know, as all of us in Boston know very well, rested upon this cotton states and the mighty labors of the African-American slaves who brought that cotton to fuel the Industrial Revolution in Britain. And it was Frederick Douglass who said in Cincinnati, "Let the engine of the Magna Carta beat against the Jericho walls of slavery." It was the slaves, going back to the fugitive slaves and to Olaudah Equiano in the 18th century, who renewed Magna Carta as a document of human freedom. And they waived Magna Carta when William Lloyd Garrison at Park Street in 1829 on the 4th of July said it was a disastrous day. He was thinking of slavery, but what redeemed it for Frederick Douglass and many others was Magna Carta. Magna Carta became the basis for an anti-slavery struggle.
Let's hear from Peter, who's on calling us from Houston, Minnesota. Peter, hello.
Hello. We are in deep, deep trouble. We worship here competition. We worship here rugged individualism. All of these things are against the Magna Carta. The Magna Carta would free us from some of these nonsenses and allow us to go back to communitarian things. We have to have community, but we can't have it on the terms that are defined by American ideals. It really is painful to listen to Bush, to listen to the GOP, to listen to all the flag-waving nonsense, and to understand that when you talk about communitarianism in this country, you are accused of being a communist. That has nothing to do with communism. But we have to be communitarian. We have to consider each other. The Magna Carta is a great document. If we could hear more about it and understand more how it applies to us, we might survive. But we can't survive as we're doing now.
Peter, thanks for your call. William's on the line from Madison, Wisconsin. William, hi.
Well, I can understand. Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I can understand the points that you're making, but I think right now America and the people of the world, they have a problem. They have a moral problem. They have an ethics problem. And I don't think that the Magna Carta is going to address that problem, what they have. It seems to me persons, for the most part, are in denial about what's really real and true. And before it is, I think, that humanity can make any advancement, they've got to come to terms with those kind of things. And that is about, and the answers there lie within the within the realm of what is absolute knowledge. Not a redundancy and a rehash of history, but directions made in the survival of human beings and the development of a system of ethics, what allows every individual freedom and truth.
William, thanks for your call. Peter Linebaugh, when I heard you describing a moment ago what you believe the Magna Carta encapsulates, it went through my mind that you were describing almost a sort of socialist testament.
It's true. Socialists have claimed Magna Carta in the past. William Morris in Great Britain, for instance, in the 1790s it was claimed by the radical Jacobins. Before that, the Americans, many Americans had claimed it as well. I think certainly the people who have brought this question back to the United States are the migrants and immigrants who have come from an experience of commons themselves, from Salvador, from Nigeria, from Somalia. Here are people who have faced that expropriation in their first generation, but they are a great resource for us in America because they have experience with struggle and they also have an experience with the commons. And to see what the so-called illegal immigrant as a world treasure has arrived here, I think can help us understand how the commons can be helpful for us in the future.
But, Jack, that seems to imply that when people on Friday celebrate freedoms, the freedoms enshrined in the Declaration of Independence, if they base that celebration on what went before in the Magna Carta, if Peter Linebaugh is right, they're only celebrating half of it.
That's right. They're leaving out this other part, the things in common. And it's hard for them to find sustenance of that for that in our history, which is, as our caller said, an individualist history. But, you know, rugged individualism was outdated in Herbert Hoover's day. And in the age of the computer, the age of globalization, of the multinational corporation, of networks of interdependence unimaginable before, individualism is now almost pathetically outdated. And yet it continues. The individual continues to define all our idea of rights. The law begins and ends with his or her rights. We assert our rights against the state and so on. And it's as if the reality of our lives are full of these common challenges, and yet our vocabulary, especially our political vocabulary, is still famished with these individualist myths.
But just thinking back to what we were discussing on the show last night, Benjamin Franklin, the new biography that has just been published, here was a man who was a commercial being. He believed in making money. He believed in entrepreneurship. That was what the Founding Fathers were about.
It was what they were about, but they also believed in this notion of republican freedom, that freedom just couldn't simply be, you know, being let alone, that there had to be a positive dimension to it. Ironically, slavery gave that to them. Our freedom and the freedom those men had, many of them, was rested on slavery. They had leisure. But that was their idea of freedom, that freedom couldn't, it had to have this economic dimension. And they were hard put to understand how an employee could be a free person, because the boss would say, vote for this person and you lose your job. No, you had to stand on your own 2 feet. You could only do that if you had your own ground, your own land.
But the biggest part of the working class at the time of the Declaration of Independence were the sailors. And it was the impressment or the forced labor of the sailors that was forced on the attention of Thomas Jefferson. And you will find it in the Declaration of Independence, which is certainly not a document of collective bargaining, certainly not a document that'll put food on the table, and yet it has been forced there.
You use that phrase, putting food on the table. Mm. Is that what we're really talking about? The ability of people, wherever they are, to feed themselves, not to be dependent on others?
No, I think, that's one way of looking at it.
I mean, that's
Robin,
one reason of access to the land.
Both when Jack read Shelley earlier, and you think of Coleridge or others in the English tradition, it's not just common resources, but it's labor in common as well. It's working with others in the fields. It's working with others in the forest. You can see it now in Nigeria. You can see the men with their cups trying to take leaks from the petroleum pipelines, you know, just as you will find people in the Industrial Revolution digging up coal in the Thames at low tide. These are part of an actual commoning experience.
If people had recalled better what you say is enshrined here in the Magna Carta, would the world be a significantly different place? Would it look different?
Oh, yes, it would. I think first we'd have the people of the reeds between the Tigris and the Euphrates, for a start. It would look very different.
Would America look different?
It certainly would. There have been many, just as there's been the strand of competitive individualism, America is a country of great visionaries. America is a country that has the fantastic experience of centuries of Native American visionaries. It has a huge experience of collective commoning of African American slavery. This is very much at the heart of any narrative of the American past, and which we sorely need now.
Would it also be a poorer country in material terms?
Well, I think maybe some people might cut back on the number of boats they might have, or on the size of their vehicles. But I think there are people thinking about this, and that kind of thinking is taking place where the great privatizers meet. It took place in Geneva this summer. It began in Seattle. It's taking place in Latin America among the homeless. Here is where the discussion and here is where mankind's future lies.
Peter Linebar, Jack Beatty, stay with us. We're talking tonight about the secret history and the modern significance of the Magna Carta. Join our conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And you can read the text of the Magna Carta and Peter Linebar's article on our website, onthepointradio.org. I'm Robin Lustig, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Robin Lustig, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Tonight we're taking a new look at the Magna Carta and at what it says about community rights. Should indigenous people look to the 800-year-old Magna Carta when their land is taken by commercial interests? Can local community rights exist in this modern multinational world? You can join our conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined in the studio this evening by Professor Peter Linebar and On Point News analyst Jack Beatty. Mike is on the line from Madison, Wisconsin. Mike, good evening.
Hello. Your interpretation is very correct, or very creative, I guess. But if you look at Magna Carta and you look at the last part of it, it has enforcement proceedings there, There's no record of those ever being initiated. It's not at all mentioned in Shakespeare's King John. It only gets mentioned in the 1620s when the problem became how to proceed against a tyrant king, if you will. They didn't quite understand it that way. But it's a feudal document, and with the exception of very few things like the pledge about trial by jury, there's no place for the common people in the document, and it's a misreading of it to say that there is.
Okay, Mike, let me stop you there and see what Peter Linebaugh has to say about that.
Yeah, I think it's certainly a misreading of the conventional view of Magna Carta. Certainly Magna Carta is a feudal document. Certainly it's a contract, you might say, between the sovereign king and his barons. But it's within a particular ecology. It's within a particular environment of social relations. This is what we are finding. And it's that environment that I think needs to be brought back. When we speak of widows' estovers, I'm not saying that every widow can go down to the park and take the fence palings and chop down the oaks on the Boston Common. What I am saying is we need a single-payer health system. When we don't want to reproduce the class relations of feudalism, but we wish to see what did the common people attain at that time and what are the common people losing in our time.
Isn't part of this discussion, though, inevitably going to have to be about power and where power lies? In the modern world, global corporations control a huge amount of power. Do you believe that if any kind of community rights, as you see them enshrined in the Magna Carta, were to be re-established, then those local communities in poor countries could somehow challenge the power of existing global corporations?
Robin, it's not only the indigenous people, but it's also the non-indigenous people. It's the proletarians of the world who need to unite. In the past,
I seem to remember somebody else saying that one day. Karl Marx?
That very person left out the indigenous people, you see. That very person left out the laboring women. That very person left out, but let's not get into him so much. What we have now is a tremendous opportunity, led partly by indigenous people, true. Also led by women, very true, as we've seen in the peace movement this last year. But the proletariat, the traditional working stiffs of the industrial world, are losing a huge amounts now, huge amounts in what used to be common resources, public lands, health, schools. Can we look at ourselves and say this is for the good? Can we look at ourselves and say that capitalism is a great success, bringing wealth? Wealth for whom?
Jack Beattie, do you see any clear, immediate relevance of the kind of ideas that Peter Linebaugh is talking about there and the world as it exists today?
Well, you can see it as a protest against the world, certainly. But, you know, we do have a form of collective property in this country, in the world. It's called the corporation. The scholar Pauline Maillard, Revolutionary War period, speaks of it as the most significant form of collectivism to emerge from the American Revolution. And it is we have common shares. We participate in this venture. People who buy shares do. And there has been for some years now a movement called the stakeholder movement that's trying to broaden that idea of the corporation as a collective property. It's a private property, but it's collective. Held in common to make it a bigger thing than simply the shareholder. The stakeholder is the employee.
Margaret Thatcher used to talk about people's capitalism.
There you are. And some people say, of course, the stakeholder is the community where the corporation abides and whose waters it's can or cannot pollute. But so there's an effort even within business to try to apply this communitarian language to this most, what we think of this, you know, as the very summa of private property. It is not private property. It's collective property. It's private collective property.
Let's take a call. Mordecai's on the line from Hillsborough, Wisconsin. Mordecai, hi.
Jack, Robin, thank you for your attempt at clarifying, but it falls short. We hear Professor Peter with his mystification. Guys, you know this money system is murdering our planet. You know we're choking on this monstrous Pentagon militarism, dropping bombs five times the speed of sound, and you talk about your mouthings of communitarian and your participatory capital. Please, the money system is killing the planet, killing the peoples. And you know what? I think maybe the species deserves to be dissolved. We're a bunch of termites. We're exploiting the resources. If only we could remove ourselves so that the animals and the plants could have a chance to survive. Anyway, get serious, guys, and keep up the good talk. Thank you.
Mordecai, thanks very much. Al is on the line from Dorchester in Maine. Al, hi.
Hi, thank you.
Okay.
I want to go back to an earlier discussion about rugged, you know, the supposed dichotomy between rugged individualism and the community.
Yeah.
And my contention is that that's a false dichotomy and a dangerous one. But the real question is probably not whether individualism is a bad thing, but whether too few individuals have too much of the power over the resources that we have. And if they do, which I think is true, how to deal with that. I would argue that a community worth preserving at all is one that regards the opportunities and rights of its individuals as fully and deals with those, takes care of those as fully as it can, and allows people to be left alone in their own lives, but also insists on full participation as equally as possible in collective matters.
Okay, let's hold it there. Peter Linebud, what do you make of that?
Well, I was just thinking about how SUVs are built, how much collectivity goes into the construction. I mean, I'm from Toledo, where we make Jeep Cherokees and have a new plant. It's owned by a Stuttgart firm, Daimler-Benz. But this is a type of collectivity under despotism. You see, you have to do what the foreman says. You have to do what the plant manager says. But supposing as a skilled tradesman or as a man or a woman on the line, you had your own ideas about transportation. Supposing there was collective decision-making and not just collective labor on behalf of the boss. I think this is the difference, Jack, between the collectivity of the corporation and a commons.
Let me just put this to you, though, Peter Linebud. Some people listening to you will say, here is a guy, he's a hopeless romantic. He wishes the world today is like it was 300 years ago. He wants to turn the clock back. He wants to undo everything that has made this country what it is.
I would say they're dead right. I am a hopeless romantic. I confess it. I proclaim it. Another world is possible. We must find another world, and it must be a romantic one. The realist one that you call for is failing. It's failed. But I think our history, Robin, here you got me wrong, I think our history is full of hope. And this is what I'm looking for. I'm taking one of the fundamental principles of Anglo-American jurisprudence, because I think it's been perverted by President Bush, Ashcroft, Ridge. I think the four points I began with concerning torture, the jury, the rule of law, and habeas corpus are being massacred. And I think if we as Americans, as people of the planet, we need to restore these individual rights. And to do so this time, I think we need also to restore our commons.
Professor Peter Linebaugh, Professor of History at the University of Toledo, author of The Secret History of the Magna Carta, which appears in the latest issue of Boston Review magazine. Thanks for being with us, Jack Beattie, On Point News Analyst, Senior Editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Thank you, too. You can read the text of the Magna Carta and Peter Linebaugh's article on our website, onpointradio.org. In a moment, a Liberian-American reflects on his war-torn homeland. This is On Point. President Bush is likely to send American soldiers into war-torn Liberia, senior U.S. officials said today. A formal announcement of the mission could come as early as tomorrow and could involve as many as 1,000 troops. Bush makes his first trip to Africa this weekend. Liberia has been ravaged by civil war for the past 14 years, and intense fighting between rebels and troops loyal to President Charles Taylor recently exploded in the capital, Monrovia, after a short-lived June 17th ceasefire. Dallas resident Ramses Nah grew up in Liberia before he moved to the U.S. for school in 1987. He has returned once since in 2001. In this radio diary, Ramses Nah reflects on the Liberia he knew as a child and the one he sees today.
The Liberia that I saw in 2001 versus what I left, two different, vastly different place. When I left home in 1987, there was light, there was water, there was functioning transportation, functioning schools, a more robust kind of individuals you saw back home, smiling people. The Liberia that I saw in 2001 when I went home, no light, no water, bullet holes everywhere. Checkpoint security guards everywhere. Young kids in the street who claim to be member of the security forces. You go out at night. You try to get home by 8 o'clock before the sun goes down. People were just so afraid and so destitute. Hundreds of people you see clogged at, around the Western Union office in anticipation of money from abroad and just to make a living. It's sad. The children today in Liberia do not know school. All they know is violence, guns, drugs. And that's sad. I think of my brothers and sisters back in Liberia, not only my blood relatives, but the people of Liberia who where I left in 1987. And today, and in 2001, the people that I saw. It's a sad story. All they want for you to do, send money so they can take a ride to the nearest African country to get out of Liberia. Everybody wants for you to send them money to go to Ghana. That's all they want, money to get out of Liberia. The United States has not only a moral obligation to get involved in Liberia, but from a historical perspective, the United States has an obligation to not only contribute troops, but to lead the efforts in Liberia. Troops need to be in Liberia like yesterday. I can guarantee you, Liberians respect the United States. Even the drugged-out child soldiers in Liberia, if they do see United States troops on the ground in Monrovia, would be more than willing to give up the arms to these troops. United States can be the only source of a peaceful transition to democracy in that country.
Ramses Nah lives in Dallas, Texas. He left Liberia in 1987 and hopes to return there when the Civil War ends. I'm Robin Lustig, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.